If one big, beautiful bill has left you with one big, confusing question, turn to BHM CPA Group. Their experienced professionals break down complex changes in tax law, accounting, and business regulations so you can make informed decisions with confidence. Simplifying the complex is what BHM CPA Group does best. Don't wait. Visit BHMCPAGroup.com and let's get to work. BHM, because running a business is hard enough. Your finances shouldn't be. Visit BHMCPAGroup.com today.
Apartment People, champion, the trusted name in Columbus Living, brings you the District of Berkshire.
Man, it will be fun to live there, right by Tanger Outlet Malls. Oh my God, great location too, getting to and from Columbus, and a great deal right now.
Free rent until next year. Free rent until next year.
He ain't lying. Move in now. You don't pay rent until next year.
The District at Berkshire. Available now at livewithchampion.com. That's livewithchampion.com. That's livewithchampion.com.
It's The Wonky Show. We're back. Gavin Williamson has given Vice Chancellors a lecture on Zoom. We'll read those runes. There's a strange year for clearing to get our head around. The Student Futures Commission has a report out and stuff on international students. It's all coming up.
We can promote, led by the government, as in the, it said in the report, the idea of the UK as welcoming all we want, but it does have to live up to that when the students get here. And given the news today that this very same government is, you know, ordering lifeboats of refugees to be sent back across the channel, I'm not sure we can live up to that.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Jim Dickinson, and here to help us make sense of what's been going on this week, as usual, a couple of fantastic guests. In Nottingham, Paul Greatrix is registrar at the University of Nottingham. Paul, your highlight of the week, please.
It's been a very exciting week for me, Jim, but the highlight for me was a real in-person event on Monday, a big opening of our new Biodiscovery Institute at the University of Nottingham. Loads of big wigs there and lots of interesting science to see. It felt like the most exciting thing that had happened in the university in years.
Excellent. And in Exeter, Sunday Blake is part of the Strategic Delivery Unit at the University of Exeter. Sunday, your highlight of the week, please.
My highlight is quite a personal one, actually. I have five pictures of myself as a child, and I was holding a book that I got given as a child, and another picture of myself as a child fell out. So the amount of pictures I have of myself as a child has gone up by 20%.
Excellent. Obviously we'll be including that picture in the show notes. So yes, we start this week with the University's UK conference. Vice Chancellors gathered in person at Northumbria University for their annual shindig. Sunday, what went off?
Well, the University's UK conference began today, and it was the first time in almost 2 years that the UK higher education sector has actually been able to come together in person. It was a chance for the community to discuss some of the most pressing issues facing us, not least the government's plans for research skills and free speech, as well as the question of how we will return to a form of normality after the pandemic. University's UK President Steve West's speech in the role, his inaugural speech in the role, I should say, touched on the theme of moving past the pandemic and into the future. He mentioned universities and the talent and research they nurture were one of the many parts of British life that stepped up to the coronavirus challenge. And he asked that universities build on the momentum of the work surrounding the pandemic and take the opportunities it presents to rethink how higher education works. However, he also looked cautiously ahead to the comprehensive spending review and the difficult economic situation it seeks to remedy. He made a call on the government not to defund education at such a crucial time for the country, but instead redouble its efforts to support both research and innovation and the important social mobility work carried out by universities across the country.
Excellent. Do you know what? It took me right back listening to Steve West, because he was the, he wasn't Vice Chancellor, he was just a Dean of Health when I was a sabbatical officer before the dawn of all time. So it was really, you know, it took me right back listening to Steve West kind of going on this morning. You know, it was a good old fashioned, you know, rabble rousing, you know, wrap up all the issues in the sector thing. And then Paul, Gavin Williamson came on next. And actually, Paul, before I ask you for a view, let's hear a bit.
There have been too many instances where pockets of low quality have undermined the teaching or value for money that students and taxpayers rightly expect. Lowering the bar for certain groups of students serves no one. It is patronizing to expect less from some students under the guise of supporting them. Effective academic writing requires good spelling, punctuation, and grammar from every student. It's so disappointing to see some in the field of higher education cling to the myth that the quality of a course or degree makes no difference to a student's outcomes. While it may be comforting for some institutions, what it is actually saying is that it don't believe in education.
Well, I'm glad we were able to hear a bit of his speech, because I must confess I only read it. I couldn't... I couldn't bring myself to listen to it, but my diary precluded listening to it live. I think there's lots of speculation about whether the Secretary of State was about to be reshuffled out of his role into some other exciting opportunity. But as it turns out, he was there to deliver his speech. He was there on the screen, but there was an irony lost on, I suspect, literally no one, of him exhorting universities to do much more in-person teaching whilst delivering a presentation over Zoom. But I think, as you say, Jim, in your piece in Wonky Today on your analysis of this, it was a kind of bit of a greatest hits package for the Secretary of State, rehearsing lots of issues around, you know, PQA, low quality courses, progression rates, and of course free speech. And the thing that struck me about his speech was that, I mean, he did refer to, you know, this litany of free speech issues in universities, which again are, you know, generally unevidenced, but he did actually refer to national figures, national heroes who'd been prevented from talking in universities. And I'm still trying to work out who those national heroes actually are, but it was familiar terrain, I think, for all of us. There remains deep anxiety about what will happen in the spending review. I think in the Q&A, he demonstrated that he's got as good idea about what's going on as any of us outside the Treasury. So, you know, it was, I think, what we would expect from a Secretary of State. And, you know, there were some points of alignment with Steve West, but unfortunately, I suspect not as many as ideally a sector would hope for.
Sunday, what stood out for you?
Oh, gosh. I did think it was a little bit funny that he was telling universities not to debate statues, because I thought it was very rich coming from a man who spends his time tweeting about what posters students can have on their walls or not. I think both. I know that Paul said that he didn't see much synchronicity between the two speeches. I spotted one, and it did infuriate me a little bit, and that was that they both touched upon the resilience and worth of the sector during the pandemic. And, you know, that's important, and I'm glad that that was mentioned. But I do think that they both skimmed over the very real human value of rising to this challenge. I think, you know, in particular, it's quite bold to speak of the future of research when so many potential future researchers, current postgraduate researchers at UK universities, were completely disregarded by the state funding body, UKRI. And it's also, I thought it was also quite audacious to speak of social mobility when the marginalised demographics in this group were even more impacted. You know, disabled and chronically ill PhD students were writing open letters against this and asking for more funding or funding extensions. But, you know, they were the ones who were told to shield weeks before a national lockdown. And that did have an effect on their research and their lab time, with many who have said that they're considering leaving the sector. So, yeah, there has been an incredible rise from researchers in universities. But at what cost? I know, as well as anyone else, that there's a deep exhaustion across the sector. Gavin Williams admits that the last 18 months have tested administration systems to breaking point. But, you know, it's not administration systems, it's administrators, it's people. Resilience can't run universities. The determination that Gavin mentioned can't run universities. Our universities, institutions need forthright and courageous leadership at this time to say, yeah, we are doing a fantastic job, but give us more support.
And that question of funding, Paul, I mean, you know, one of the things that strikes me about the social care debate this week is the Treasury sort of slipped out news that in the CSR, DfE has got to find 5% efficiency savings. Now, I doubt that'll be coming from schools. And, you know, universities and colleges have already got to find the the kind of employer half of the increase in national insurance that, you know, announced this week. So, you know, it makes for a really, really difficult CSR, really. And he wasn't giving anything away on that, was he?
No, and I think there, you know, there is real anxiety in the sector because, I mean, the point about resilience is, you know, is true up to point, as Sunday says, but the, you know, the reality is that universities and colleges have done it themselves on the whole, right? There has been, you know, very little actual material support other than the same that, you know, some other businesses have had in terms of furlough. So, you know, we have really struggled as a sector to keep our heads above water and provide the services that we need to our students and our staff. And I think the anxiety about what's coming down the track is real. It is absolutely real. But having made all those savings that we did, you know, the idea of having to make further savings, which will challenge all of those support mechanisms, and having those extra costs on top, and you know, we all, you know, we're expecting additional pension costs as well to come down the track. It is going to be really, really hard. And all, the other point I think to make is that the issue about you know, government has talked big on investment and research and the importance of this in terms of the sector in the long term, but has yet to deliver on that promise. And I think it, you know, the kind of pipeline of investment looks to keep, you know, getting further and further into the future. And that's, again, a further anxiety for universities looking to support researchers and to support research, which matters to the country. So, yeah, I think everyone's pretty anxious at the moment, Jim.
One thing I'm very conscious of is that, you know, as I said in the speech, I really want to drive up quality right across the university sector. I want to make sure that, you know, we drive up not just, you know, right across, you know, not just about, you know, dealing with but the absolute lowest quality, but also driving up the standards right across the board. And I do appreciate that that needs funding. We have one of the world's best university sectors, I would say far better than any other nation in terms of the way we lead, in terms of research, the opportunities that we give the students. And I do recognise that part of that is the fact that we have a funding mechanisms that universities are able to invest in that. And it is something that is really so important to me that we protect that position and we protect universities' ability to invest in students. I think the quid pro quo to that has to be, we need to be, you know, we as a nation, we invest billions of pounds every single year in the higher education sector, and students do as well. And as part of that deal, we need to be looking at how we're ensuring that the outcomes for those students deliver their hopes and aspirations, but also deals with some of the real issues that this country has in terms of the gaps that we have in terms of our economy and how the university sector can really...
It's the season of gratitude. We love this time of year because it helps us to actually take the time to focus on all that we truly have and all that we're thankful for.
At Simple Bath & Kitchen, all of you pop to the top of that list. Our Columbus community has allowed our SB&K team to work in your most sacred place, your home.
We understand that privilege, and we're so happy that by remodeling your bathroom and your kitchen, you've become part of our family.
At Simple Bath & Kitchen, we're grateful for you.
Play its role in terms of plugging some of those gaps. But I think if we can do that, drive out the poor quality, continue to drive up standards, make sure that there is a laser-like focus in terms of outcomes for students, you know, we can constantly demonstrate the real value for money that universities are delivering. And that's certainly everything that I have been doing and will continue to do in terms of every one of my discussions across government, including with the department that you're probably most interested in.
Sunday, I mean, you know, as we've discussed before, if you want to save money on higher education, partly because the Treasury is telling you to, partly because you want to spend it on FE, you can reduce the number of people that go, reduce the amount of money you spend per head, and or get graduates to pay back more. Now, Steve West was very keen in his speech to rule out kind of option one and option two and didn't really say anything on graduate repayments, perhaps inevitably. But after this week, I mean, I've seen three or four news stories this week that are really concerned about the graduate kind of marginal, the marginal tax rate that is now being faced by graduates as a result of the national insurance hike. It becomes harder, doesn't it, to suddenly make that little tweak that people talk about, which is to take the graduate repayment threshold down to, say, £20,000. Surely that's harder as a result of the national insurance stuff now this week.
I'll be honest, I'm panicking about it all. I think one of the things that you can kind of link into this as well is that there are a lot of students doing what is sort of colloquially known as a panic master's as well. And obviously that is going to add on to repayment threshold as well if it does come down. I've been avoiding these stories because they just give me too much anxiety, which might actually, it might be, that might be your answer in itself. Like it's so stressful at the moment to be a recent graduate. I'm sorry, I can't give you any more opinion on that. It's just, even as I'm answering your question, I can feel my heart rate going
up. Isn't that interesting? Because, you know, when the graduate repayment threshold was designed at 20, you know, it was a different housing market, different graduate employment market, different mental health state of, you know, graduates, and a different national insurance contributions. And now, you know, all of that has become more, you know, significantly more difficult. And I'm, you know, I'm looking at it thinking, where will they go? I mean, if you stop people going based on their A-level or GCSE results, that has a significant impact on some students. If you restrict on the basis of exit outcomes, which was one of the bits of Gavin's speech today, kind of pressuring OFS, that has massive impacts on other parts of the sector in terms of social mobility. But you know, you also can't really soak young graduates much further, particularly when you start to eat into the sort of people who've moved back in with their parents in the Shires. Do you know what I mean? This starts to impact on, you know, that kind of those stories this week about, you know, what happened to the party that was the party of low tax. And I think, you know, if for years we've been saying, well, student loans aren't really a loan, they're more of a tax, suddenly the big story this week was, well maybe the tax is too high.
Yeah, I think it is a really difficult situation. But I do think the idea of, you know, as people often say, putting a cap on ambition by limiting numbers, it would be an extraordinarily unpopular move. Yes, by all means, expand other opportunities for people. But, you know, there is still, as I'm sure we'll talk about in a moment, massive demand for higher education because it's a good thing. But I agree with you. I think piling more onto people who've already graduated is materially unfair. And also I do think that, you know, cutting headline fees will actually, you know, make little difference to graduates in terms of repayment, but would make a huge difference to universities in a negative way. So I think we need a different lens. I just don't know what that lens is.
And the other thing to say, Sunday, I thought that was interesting was he played fast and loose again. Government ministers keep doing this. With 1 minute he was talking about, we need to do something for the 50% of people that don't go to uni.
Yeah.
Then the next minute he's saying, well, we need to change the preferences of a whole bunch of people who do go to uni.
It's, yeah.
Like, well, are you aiming at here?
This really confused me, actually, because he actually introduced this point by saying that we're entering a new era of greater choice, so that people...
Oh, yes. Okay. This will be the passage where we're entering a new era of less choice.
I'll tell you what, like, I would say that actually a lot of the students did not, the recent graduates from this cohort did not get the university experience they signed up to, and they did not get the loan repayment experience that they agreed to. So I don't really understand why anyone's got any choice in this or any autonomy. But also, you know, this idea that people, you know, we're going to have greater choice and people don't have to go to university, but the UCAS data isn't suggesting that. You know, if we're entering greater choice for people outside of, you know, higher education routes, well, the students don't seem to know that. And I mentioned the panic masters earlier. I would say at the moment, the evidence is pointing to prospective students perceiving and making choices on this perception that there are less options outside of HE, you know, for example, in the world of work. So that's not lining up to this apparent new era.
Well, what did you think of the moment where he was effectively saying that, you know, on that proceed measure, that moment where you kind of multiply the percentage of people who graduate having enrolled and the percentage of people who get a graduate job within 15 months, that providers that are on less than 50%, you know, that would be unacceptable. I mean, if they applied that at subject level, as I've said in the blog today, it's a hell of a lot of subjects at a hell of a lot of universities that would have to go.
I mean, I think it's extraordinarily problematic, but just shows you the danger of, you know, making broad brush policy announcements based on, you know, single points of data, which are wholly imperfect as well for the reasons that you describe. I mean, you know, there are all sorts of reasons why certain courses behave in different ways. Many of them are discipline specific. Yes, there are certain courses in certain universities, which, you know, because of the origins of students, means that they are much, much more challenged in terms of their ability to progress. So I just think it's just the wrong indicator to base those kind of decisions on funding about. You know, the fact that you can actually get anywhere near 50% of people through some courses, given their backgrounds, history and circumstances, and given the nature of the course, is in many cases a staggering achievement. You know, so I just think it's the wrong indicator for a wrong decision myself.
My favourite of these, by the way, that I think I've mentioned on the podcast before, is Norland College, which is the How to Become a Posh Nanny College, which I rather kind of dismissively have tended to call Mary Poppins College on Twitter. And I'm not taking the piss out of what they do. I think what they do is really interesting.
You are taking the piss, Jeff.
I'm not. It's vocational. It's actually really interesting, you know, a really interesting degree. But of course, not a single one of those students has what is defined as a graduate job within 15 months because, you know, being a nanny for posh people in London isn't defined in the codes as a graduate job. And I mean, you know, that just brings it home, doesn't it, how problematic some of these kind of measures are.
It's really interesting that you mentioned nanny, because it just made me think of like, obviously caring for children, and it reminded me of him sort of gloating a little bit over the lifelong entitlement loan and praising it for its ability to fit around personal circumstances like childcare or work or disability, which, you know, that's fine financially, but I was sort of listening to him thinking that, you know, we all know that things like remote study over the pandemic has helped students with those exact commitments. And yet the steer he gave later on was to remove this completely.
Return to your classroom.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, that's okay for financial support, but finance isn't the only accessibility issue or barrier for students. And sorry, I'm on a roll now. That wasn't the only contradiction. He actually heavily implied that universities need to be quick off the mark to return to normal, but then later on shamed universities for inadequate teaching provision for disabled students. And I thought, well, what is it, Gavin? A quick pivot back to normality?
Cakeism. That's what it
i.e.
is.
Yeah, the conditions which uphold bad provision for disabled students, or universities take a little while longer to implement accessibility for all in the long term. It was just a sort of string of contradictions, and then he went on to call online provision a cost-cutting exercise. And I was like, I'm getting whiplash here, you know, like, what is going on? Does he know how many hours it takes to go to upload online learning resources? But and also, where's the money for this disabled provision, Gavin? You know, it was just a nightmare.
And so on and so on. Anyway, good. Lots more analysis and so on the site as ever. Links are in the show notes on wonky.com. Good. Right. Let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Sustainability agenda is of increasing importance to universities and the whole HE sector. My name's Dr. Fiona Cowney. I'm an associate professor at Bournemouth University, and I've just written a piece for Wonky, which asks whether universities intentionally or unintentionally are guilty of greenwashing. Are universities overclaiming on the sustainable practices that they engage in? Are they thinking critically about the kinds of things that they do in order to attract students to their institutions? Are we as academics clearly thinking about how we can engage with the sustainability agenda within the curriculum? I hope that you find the article interesting, and I hope it enables you to reflect on your practice for the year ahead. Thank you.
Now, meanwhile this week, figures released by UCAS show a funny old clearing season, Paul.
They do. And I mean, as always, it seems to me, because I've got a very short memory, it was another record year for acceptances onto full-time undergraduate courses. And it always seems to be a record year. But the numbers have
gone
up.
Which direction was the scramble this
year? It's a positive story. But what is different, and obviously you're right, we always have a scramble of one kind or another. It's the word that always comes into play. That actually, it was less. Because of the change in grades, it meant that that with higher A-level grades, fewer ended up students ended up in clearing because many more reached their offer. So it was less activity in clearing, which is obviously, you know, in a sense, good news for universities as well as for some students. The significant issues in this for me were. One is the real huge drop in EU students, right? Really declined heavily, down 56% on last year, apparently. So that's a big drop. But those from beyond the EU up 5%. So that's, you know, good news, bit of swings and roundabouts there. But I think the fact of the increase in A-level grades has meant that some universities have ended up recruiting more students. Some of those they planned to recruit, others of those they probably didn't. They just got their algorithms wrong. But I do think that the overall picture is encouraging. And as we were saying before, I mean, you know, it demonstrates that actually, you know, higher education is a great choice for lots of people. It's bound to be a more popular choice at times of economic uncertainty, which we're living in now. But it remains a great choice. Yes, there is an extended loan period after graduation, but actually it remains and looks on paper and feels like, a good investment for lots of people. Yes, there are plenty of other choices, but I think the reality is that the other choices are in practice relatively limited, and the higher education options look much more attractive. The Brexit impact on EU students is unsurprising.
Apartment People, Champion, the trusted name in Columbus Living, brings you the District of Berkshire.
Man, it will be fun to live there, right by Tanger Outlet Malls. Oh my God, great location too, getting to and from Columbus, and a great deal right now.
Free rent until next year. Free rent until next year.
He ain't lying. Move in now. You don't pay rent until next year.
The District at Berkshire. Available now at livewithchampion.com. That's livewithchampion.com. That's livewithchampion.com.
Surprising. And of course, the international numbers do remain precarious until pretty late in the day. You don't know they're coming until they're actually here. And of course, the issues around, you know, red list countries, around quarantine, make it much, much harder, not to mention the vagaries of visa issuing, make it much more uncertain about who will actually turn up. So there remains anxiety in admissions team up and down the country about international numbers. But the overall picture in terms of home numbers actually looks really positive, I think.
Sunday, the stat that jumped out at me was this idea that this time last year there were 117,000 free to be placed in clearing people, and that's now 145,000. Why aren't what's going on there? Is it that more people applied kind of speculatively and they've now changed their mind? Is it there's loads of jobs in bars that are paying 40 grand? I mean, what's going on?
I think one of the things that hasn't been discussed that much, or I haven't seen discussed that much, is that a lot of, you know, my generation, Generation Z, I think there's an underestimation of how much we have to base our decisions on immediacy. So what is our immediate situation right now? You know, we talk a lot about long-term planning, but, you know, we don't have pensions, we don't have houses, we get married later. And I speak as someone who went to university because I didn't have parents to support me, and the state were going to give me 10 grand to look after myself. So, like, that, you know, that these decisions, yeah, right. But, you know, that there are, we are an incredibly precarious generation, and it wouldn't surprise me at all if many applicants are making decisions based on the immediacy of their current situation, which is incredibly precarious as well.
Yeah, and it's interesting, isn't it, Paul? Because I mean, actually, this time last year, you know, taking a year out, either because, you know, you wanted to travel or you needed the money, wasn't really a thing, but it, you know, may well be a thing this year. But I mean, the other thing I was going to ask Paul is, these global figures are what they are, but under the surface, there's a distribution of these numbers, isn't there, around the sector and even within universities. You know, there's quite a, I think, you know, some of the stories I've heard are quite sharp increases and decreases that, you know, aren't highlighted here in the global numbers.
That's right. I mean, and individual institutions can be in a position where they're, you know, they are you know, significantly under in certain subjects and massively over in others. And that can cause huge logistical problems, you know, from everything from timetable to actual staff to do the teaching, etc. And, you know, if you've got a big bulge, you end up with difficulties with accommodation as well. And, you know, so there can be real difficulties within an institution. What I haven't quite got a sense of, it's often said that if, you know, Russell Group universities all over recruit, then that creates problems for, you know, for other universities outside the Russell Group who find themselves, you know, chasing students, and then, you know, some universities miss out. It's much more complicated than that. But there is a sense, I think, in which Russell Group universities have recruited more than they did the previous year. That's possibly because of excess demand in certain subject areas, such as medicine and health sciences, where there are a lot of places in Russell Group universities. But I don't get a sense of where the challenges between in certain universities actually are at the moment. That will come clear in the next few weeks, I guess. But yeah, these things do cause huge perturbations within institutions and between subjects, and then leads to longer term issues around resource allocation within universities and what that actually means, because you often find yourself having to invest more in, you know, psychology and law, which have, you know, over recruited, but actually you don't want to disinvest, you know, from other subjects, because you know that you'll be looking to bounce back next year, and also you've got to support the students who are currently there, so you end up, you know, recruiting more, and then that adds to your cost base, and you've got to find other ways to make savings. So lots of challenges caused by what on the surface of it looks like a general increase.
Now, every week on the show, we delve deep into the sector's past to discover stories of how things were and how things came to be. With Nottingham Trent's Academic Registrar, Mike Ratcliffe, here's the hidden history of HE.
One of the things I think makes history of higher education interesting is the amount of continuity and the amount of change that we see. So one of the things I really enjoy is looking at old regulations of how we looked after students. Sometimes that's quite useful because you get really good ideas of how you regulate students now in the present. But I think sometimes it just shows us that we're still dealing with some of the same challenges. So my favourite set of these regulations is the Statutes of the Collegium Sapientiae at Freiburg University, which were written in 1497. And they are beautiful. They are illustrated, which I think is a great idea. You know, we should run that out across universities anyway. But they cover the whole of student life. They were written by a bishop who'd been working with the university for a long time. He understood what students got up to, and he set out a complete set of rules. So it has everything you could possibly want to run a proper university. So it's got rules about how you welcome a student to the university, how you make a list of the furnishings in their room, so it gets an inventory, and so that they're clear that they've got to account for everything that's in the rooms. There's a system for allocating the rooms. It's done by lottery, so no one can have the good rooms on favouritism, and they're quite clear rules about what time you have to go to bed, and that there's study time, everyone should be quiet. You have to clean your room once a week. There's a great set of rules for how you have to make your bed immediately after you've risen in the morning, and then you get into the excitement, which is the penalty system. So the regulation says failure to comply as a result of laziness when noticed during the weekly inspection and reported to the president shall be punished by the removal of wine. If this should happen frequently, the scholar in question shall be deprived of his bed. Great thing about all of these regulations is basically the tariff system is how much wine you have removed for the different infringements you go through. Now, we have to remember that obviously wine was a different kind of commodity. It was, you know, a drinkable drink. It wasn't quite the same as having your vodka-based confection taken away from you by the university, but that's how it works. You go through and you get all these punishments. So there's a whole bunch of things that these people are not allowed to do. They're kind of clerks in lay orders, so they're kind of semi-religious, but it's very clear there's lots of things they shouldn't be getting on to. So there's to be no loose frivolous or obscene song, no blasphemy and no kinds of boasting. Dice, cards and sticks for casting lots on all games of chance are forbidden. Disregard of this rule should be punished with the loss of wine for a week. Chess, however, is allowed. And it goes on. So there are these lovely things. So again, one of the things we do is we often contrast ourselves with people in the US. So there's a lot of very clear rules about no arms allowed. So you have to hand your sword into the president when you arrive at the college. If you need it back, you can go and get it when you know, if you're going outside town, but you're not allowed to keep it in the hall. And there are very clear rules about no fighting in the college and what you do with it. And as you go through the sets of regulations, each has this wonderful little illustration showing you exactly what's going on. So there's everything is beautifully set out and laid down. But it's a pocket set of rules, and most of it, probably apart from the swords, is entirely applicable to the modern university.
Now, back in the spring, the UPP Foundation asked Mary Curnock-Cook to chair something called the Student Futures Commission. And this week we saw an interim report. Sunday, what stood out for you?
Quite a few things stood out for me. I think one thing that I was really in two minds about, because I was really glad that they mentioned it, but I was also disappointed with the fact that there were no follow-up policy recommendations or advice. And that was that they touched upon the fact that students with little to no drug use experience may well be encountering recreational substances in their first couple of weeks of term. And because they haven't got experience taking drugs, they may overindulge. As I said, it was disappointing. I was glad to see this, but I thought it was disappointing that there were no policy recommendations or advice on what universities can do in terms of harm minimization. As you know, as we all know, policies around drug use vary so far across the sector. And my view is always that, you know, we can't stop students taking drugs, but we can implement harm minimization policies that promote openness around drug use and messaging to students, you know, that if they do come to the university seeking support for problematic drug use, they're going to be supported and not penalised. And, you know, the danger of not implementing such policies is that there would be this year more tragic fatalities, such as the very sad string of incidents in Northumbria last autumn. Because when students are apprehensive around disciplinaries or expulsion, there can be a delay or a complete absence in asking or calling for help. And obviously this can be fatal. And I really felt that the report should have been more directive here, especially when students' lives are at risk.
Well, do you know what, Sunday? It's very interesting that you raise that, because there's a whole bunch of stuff that I've been reading about what happens at the end of pandemics, right? And everything I've read suggests that people, particularly the young, grasp at freedom rather than safety. And, you know, indulge in significant levels of hedonistic activity. And Paul, one of the things that, you know, I think is interesting about this is 20, 30 years ago, every student union welfare officer was doing, like, you know, drug awareness stuff and alcohol awareness stuff and sexual health stuff. And actually, it's kind of gone out of fashion, a lot of that. But if we're about to get this, and it's a big if we're about to get a big spate of hedonistic risk-taking behavior amongst students, universities, student unions, student services departments, people need to kind of step up around that kind of harm minimum risk type stuff, don't they?
I think that's an excellent point. I mean, I would dispute a bit of the going out of fashion thing. I mean, I do take the point about non-legal drugs, as it were. I do think that actually there is much less focus on those issues at the moment. Regarding alcohol, I would argue there is a much greater focus, in my experience, on alcohol-related issues than I think there has ever been. And the kind of post-pandemic approach that, you know, that I think lots of universities are taking is how do we, at the same time as providing a kind of meaningful and helpful return to, you know, a more typical study model for students starting and returning to university this autumn, at the same time, how do we provide the environment which enables them to at least, you know, explore elements of that hedonistic lifestyle that they feel that they will have missed for the past 18 months, whilst at the same time helping them to stay safe in that environment and providing them with the support if they do fall off the rails. So I think there's a really difficult balancing act. And that's not to mention that the kind of pressure from local communities who, you know, remain concerned about any kind of, you know, student behavior, which is, you know, kind of noisy / alcohol fueled / in the early hours of the morning, and the impact that has on and other communities' lives. So I think there's a whole bunch of issues in there, but I do think the universities are trying to focus on it. Although, as Sunday says, I suspect they're not covering all of those bases to the same effect.
I think I do have a lot of respect for Mary and have a lot of respect for this report, actually. And there's stuff that I really thought was great.
Yeah, I mean, the belonging stuff is today at Universities UK conference, Mary Curnock-Cook apparently was saying, you know, belonging is the new, I can't remember what it was, the new engagement or something.
Well, we need to be the new something.
I just... I just did feel that there was almost an exclusive focus on preparedness academically, but not on social or emotional maturity. And I do think that that is an oversight, given HEPI's report into student attitudes towards sex.
Save faster, borrow smarter, move sooner with CME. Earn 6.5% APY with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus savings account. And when you're ready to buy, enjoy a low 5.1 ARM mortgage rate. Plus, CME pays $750 towards closing costs. Start your path to home ownership today with CME Federal Credit Union. Subject to membership eligibility and approval. APY means annual percentage yield. APR means annual percentage rate. Terms apply. Federally insured by NCUA. Equal housing lender. Visit cmefcu.org for details.
In April this year, which, you know, without a doubt, as you wrote on the site, Jim, showed that certain demographics of students are absolutely not prepared for the very adult experiences that they're going to encounter at university. I felt, and obviously, you know, students not being prepared academically is important as well. And they do make a really good point. You know, they cite data from the student room saying that 26% of applicants didn't feel ready. Although I did wonder what the baseline for that was. I was thinking, like, is there a baseline though from non-pandemic years of students who don't feel ready for university? And obviously they sort of make the point that, you know, it's not just content, but also the opportunity to mature study skills. And they raised an interesting point around the intense period of revisions before exams being quite helpful. And I had never thought about that before. But I did also think, well, what evidence is there for that claim? Because all the conversations I've been seeing are around the, you know, the efficacy of exams and how maybe we should move away from the exam module. So I kind of think, well, is it beneficial or not? Is exams and revisions something vital in level three learning journey that we need to not only retain, but lament that the students haven't had it this year? Or is it something that doesn't contribute to the, you know, the sort of academic maturity of our students? So there was a lot of sort of, as I was reading it, there was a lot of sort of every point that I thought that's a point well made, I then thought, oh, but what about this question? Which is how I tend to read things
and the good news is it's only an interim report and doubtless lots of opportunities to...
I did like that they made it very clear that universities need to be clear and precise about exactly what blended and hybrid mean, and they need to justify the pedagogical benefits, because we have spent the last 18 months being told how fantastic online learning is, that all students need to pay the exact same as a normal year to access it. And now suddenly everyone's banging on about how great in-person is and that we need to get back straight away. And I'm like, well, you can't have it both ways. So when I saw them, when I saw that, you know, it was quite a firm, you have to be clear and your justifications have to come forward, I thought I had a lot of respect for that point. I thought, yeah, I'm glad that someone's saying that, because it's something that's frustrated me a lot.
Good. And there's a blog from Commission Chair Mary Kernock Cook on the site, as well as link to the interim report on the UPP Foundation site. Now, news from Scotland this week, and DK is across it.
Imagine a world where a government announces stuff that it had expected to announce, and the only major concern is that the speed of delivery could be a bit faster. That world is Scotland. And for those who watch HE policy in Scotland, last Tuesday brought the first fruits of a number of prominent seeds. What feels like forever ago, Peter Scott, the Commissioner for Fair Access, made a suite of recommendations on student maintenance. Scotland has long prided itself on free higher education, but it's been a common consensus that the student support offer has lagged behind. A pledge to see the total student support package reach the equivalent of the living wage over the next 3 years goes some way towards addressing these concerns, and there's additional measure to support care experienced and estranged students. At Wonky, we've long been hoping for a proper government assessment of the student housing market, and it looks like in Scotland we will be getting one, with recommendations in the next 12 months on regulation, affordability and the role of local authorities. The big piece that remains on the table is the recommendation of the SFC's three-phase review. There will be a full government response shortly, but we already know the National University and Colleges Estate Strategy and a review of postgraduate funding are on their way in the not-too-distant future. Elsewhere, there are a raft of research announcements confirmed, and the SFC recommendation on digital learning and mental health are addressed in part. While most UK-wide interest in the programme for government has been around the ongoing question of independence for Scotland, one perhaps overlooked aspect has been a review of the fiscal framework between Holyrood and Westminster, with Scotland looking to gain new borrowing and tax-setting powers.
And finally, two big reports this week about international students, Paul.
The two reports, yeah, one of them from Universities UK and UUKI, which is looking at the country's success or otherwise in terms of international student recruitment. And it really flags a number of challenges that we have about our positioning in the world and our ability to attract international students who are, you know, fundamental to, you know, the campus experience, but also fundamental to our financial position in the sector. And I think what it does really indicate is that we need to continue to work hard and indeed work harder in terms of our promotion of the quality of UK higher education, the opportunities we offer, the potential to study and then earn afterwards through the graduate employment route, but also, you know, issues around visas and making that easy, and also something that I'd not really thought about before, which is about the need for additional support and encouragement for the English language education sector. So we've always been second to the US, but we are very, very close to being overtaken by others, particularly Australia. It's often a real competition with them. And as another report shows, actually, the massive financial benefit, £28.8 billion, highlighted in the HEPI report, with a study undertaken by London Economics, is a huge income stream for this country, right? The equivalent of £390 per person for the whole country brought in by international students. And that is a phenomenal sum of money. And that report goes on to show that actually those constituencies with the highest density of students, particularly in Sheffield and indeed my own university constituency, Nottingham South, actually the sums involved are breathtaking. And in Nottingham South, for example, the sum is 290 million. Sorry, that's the Sheffield figure, 290 million. Nottingham South, 261 million. That's £2,390 per resident. It's an extraordinary figure. So it's really insightful couple of reports, I think, but just show how important international students are, not just financially, but also in terms of the cultural and social benefits they bring to communities and the, you know, the diversity benefits for cities and communities in which they live. So I think both really, really interesting reports.
Sunday, obviously, you know, one of the things about this is about getting the welcome right, you know, welcoming international students. And there's nothing that, you know, there's nothing like being invited to spend £2,285 to spend a week in a grim Premier Inn if you're from a red list country that you're struggling to book through the system. Oh, I mean, you know, we haven't quite got this right, have we?
Okay, yeah, right. It's interesting that you bring up that self-isolation stuff, actually, because I did read in the UUKI recommendations that obviously Southeast Asia is an area that they're looking to focus on and up the intake of applicants and students from, and the work that I did last year, obviously we were dealing with lots of students from places like Korea, places like Vietnam, who were sort of being lumped together with Chinese students and all facing horrific racism in the city centre that our university had to actually come out and condemn. The recommendation that I took issue with actually was to improve the promotion of the UK as welcoming, diverse and accessible. And I think, well, that's fine to promote the UK as that, but it actually does have to be that as well.
Yeah.
Right. Now, I've worked in university for a while, and we're always told that international recruitment comes mostly from word of mouth, right? Students going home and telling their friends and family that the UK is a great place to study. But prospective students aren't stupid, and we can promote, led by the government, as in the it said in the report, the idea of the UK as welcoming all we want, but it does have to live up to that when the students get here.
Yeah.
And given the news today that this very same government is, you know, ordering lifeboats of refugees to be sent back across the channel, I'm not sure we can live up to that. And I genuinely do think that this report has missed out the impacts on of xenophobia, racism and general hostility in students' decisions. You know, if you actually looked into the data points, the ISS 2020 showed that the key factors that influence students' decisions are related to immigration and being made to feel welcome. 38% were worried about hostility. That's not a small number. 49% were less interested in the UK since Brexit. So where are the recommendations beyond surface level? You know, those students' concerns about racism don't exist in a vacuum, but I did a little control find on the document. The term racism came up once in the 86-page report, and it was in a quote from a recruitment agent in South Asia. The term discrimination in the 86-page report came up once, and that was from a Saudi student. So, you know, the student voice is there, but the recommendations aren't responding to them. And this, I'll make one more point on this. This xenophobia and hostility, it does have an impact on other recommendations in the report. So Nigerian, Saudi and Pakistani students all saw the UK as a higher quality of education than their home country, right? So that higher quality is why they'd come here rather than study at home. Now, that's fundamentally linked to our immigration policies, because if we want to offer the highest quality of teaching, we need the highest quality of teachers. So we need to be attracting the best from the global talent pool. We can't do that if they don't want to live here, or if we make it incredibly difficult for them to live here.
I completely endorse all of that. I mean, I think it's always, you know, a bit harsh to say with reports, well, they didn't include this and they didn't include that. But I absolutely agree with you, Sunday, that, you know, the environment that the country offers to welcome students is not just about promotion, right? You've got to deliver the reality of it. And every time you see a picture of a gunboat turning around a life raft, actually that's turning off another 100 international students, right? You know, it shows Britain as being unwelcoming to international people who need our help, right? Be that either because they're refugees and have got nothing, or because they want a top quality education and are prepared to pay for it, right? But it's about your national approach to these things. You can't have it both ways, right? You can't say, yes, we want to offer a great education to people who are prepared to pay, and then turn everyone else back at the border because they haven't got the right visa. It has to work all in harmony, and you have to have the attitudes and the welcoming approach, which is about challenging racism and ensuring that people are provided with the support they need where they do experience negative attitudes in communities, to make it a welcoming country. And, you know, that's something that we've got to play our part in as well.
So that's about it for this week. Remember, to dig a bit deeper into anything we've discussed today, you'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast automatically. Just search for The Wonky Show via Spotify, Apple or Google Podcasts, or wherever else you listen. And to keep you and your organisation ahead of everything going on in UKHE, do head to the website to find out more about our various subscriptions. So thanks very much to Paul, Sunday, Mike, everyone at Team Wonky that helps make the show happen. And until next week, stay wonky.
Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.